Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
I don't think riding in a fighter plane and getting shot down is a qualification to be president.
Blue Monday, how are you, Blue Monday? Got to work like a slave all day. Here come Tuesday.
It is the Savage Nation, and I'm Michael Savage, and I'm live. I'm not on vacation. And it looks to me like Wesley Clark just shot himself down, not in a fighter plane, but with his big mouth. I think Wesley Clark, who had hoped finally to use all of his aggression and his wile, would be the vice presidential choice for Barack Hussein Obama. But because he attacked John McCain in the most absurd manner, I think Wesley Clark will have to go back to doing what he does best, which is hunting for money in the corporate world, the very world he's been attacking. In fact, he poses as a reformer, Wesley Clark, if you remember him. He is the man who bombed Serbia into the Stone Age. He is the man who destroyed every bridge over the Danube River. He is the man who killed over 2,000 innocent men, women, and children in Serbia, all to make the world safer for the Kosovo Liberation Army. That's who Wesley Clark actually is, but I wouldn't expect most of you to remember who the man actually is. You also don't know that Wesley Clark may have been directly involved in the Waco raid. Nobody really knows if it's true or not. But they claim that the Waco raid, which ended in a fire that killed 75 Christians, they call them cult members, which was carried out by FBI agents, it turns out that it may have been coordinated at Fort Hood, Texas, where Clark was stationed at the time. It may turn out that two military officials from Fort Hood met with Attorney General Janet Sterno's staff in Washington before the raid. It may turn out that Fort Hood provided military equipment, including tanks and Bradley fighting vehicles, to the FBI raiders. We don't know if there's a direct link to Wesley Clark, but we do know that Wesley Clark was there. However, the fact of the matter is, Wesley Clark is a snake. And Wesley Clark today committed political harry-carry by attacking John McCain yesterday. If you missed it, listen to clip 14 again.
Well, I don't think riding in a fighter plane and getting shot down is a qualification to be president. But
well, I don't think working as a community activist in Chicago and being a bag man for strange people in Chicago is a qualification to be president either. I don't think changing your name from Barry to Barack necessarily makes you a great man. So what is it about Barack Hussein Obama that makes him a better war leader than John McCain? And I'm no big fan of wishy-washy McCain. You know that. But if I had to make a choice, if it was life or death, there's no question in my mind it's McCain. And for Wesley Clark, a guy who served, and he did serve, and he had a distinguished career himself in the military, to have said this about John McCain shows a not only a lack of judgment, but a mean, nasty spirit, terrible spirit. But he said more. And, of course, that's one topic, and there are others. A Democrat with military background assails McCain's credentials is how the official media is reporting it, but that's not exactly what the headline is. The real surrogate is Obama's stooge, Clark, attacks McCain's military background. That's my headline on michaelsavage.com, and that's the correct headline. Here are some other headlines. Newspapers bracing for more bad news. Really bad news. Very bad news. Horribly bad news. And you know, I'm not celebrating it. And I will tell you why. My industry, talk radio, depends upon good reporting. Actually, my industry depends more on bad reporting than it does on good reporting. That's quotable. You should quote me on that. Talk radio depends more on bad reporting than it does on good reporting. So I don't know what I'm going to do with all those bad reporters who are going to be sitting in cafes planning the revolution. Once they're gone, I mean, who am I going to have to kick around? Once the New York Times is gone, what's going to be left? We don't know. But in all seriousness, the fact of the matter is it's not good when good reporters are fired. And there are good reporters out there. But the newspaper business is going through its worst retrenchment in recent memory. Half a dozen newspapers said they would slash payrolls. One said it would outsource all its printing to India. And so forth and so on. It's getting worse by the day. And, you know, you can't say over and over again this is due to the internet. You can't say over and over again it's because the young people aren't reading newspapers. They're getting the news on the internet. Those facts are true. They're very true. So when you add up the fact that the number one demographic for newspapers are older people, meaning over 50, that would include me, and that our values are being trashed every day by the newspaper celebrating the most disgusting anti-American, anti-family, anti-Christian news you can imagine. It's no longer news, north, east, west, and south, which is what news stands for. I remember when I was a kid, I used to be a fan of the news at home. I used to like to watch the news. I used to wait for the evening news. Even when I was a kid, I was a news hound. Television news, newspapers. But I remember there was a weather vane, and it said north, east, west, and south. And some intelligent man in the business said, if you look at this weather vane in the proper manner, in the proper angles, you see it's NEWS, northeast, west, and south. I said, wow, that is really neat. Northeast, west, and south. Well, now, of course, the business has become not only not northeast, west, and south. All their arrows point in only one direction, which is to the left. And that is why the newspaper business is in decline. Sure, the other factors are there, but when you have a demographic that's older, and the older people grew up on American values and on family values, and those values are trashed every day by the morons who run the papers, San Francisco Chronicle, lead example, losing $1 million a week. That's right, not a million a month, not a million a year, but under the stewardship of these degenerate perverts who run the paper, they're losing $1 million a month. You know, that adds up. When you lose $52 million a year, even the Hearst Corporation, even the descendants of J. Randolph Hearst, realize that their interest is being hurt. I mean, you can only sit on a trust fund for so long until even your trustees will have to make a call every once in a while and say, honey, your interest is being eroded by the San Francisco Chronicle. Yeah, in other words, all of the are coming home to roost, whatever you want to call them. 1-800-449-8255. I know most of you are not even listening and you're not there. I know most normal people are not listening to talk radio. I know most people are not watching television. I know most people, I can tell you the roads are empty out here in Northern California because normal people are on vacation. That's where a normal person is today. They are camping. They are fishing. They have taken a road trip with a pickup camper or a tent or whatever they're doing. They're not listening to talk radio. That doesn't bother me at all. I like the summers. I get a lot done in the summer. In fact, just last night, it was Saturday night at 11:30 at night, I sent off the last 12 pages of my new book to the transcription service. Can you believe that? That's right. I, Michael Savage, took all. It was very depressing, by the way. These are the stories. I got to read you some of the headline. You know, whoever is listening to my show today, this is the diehard core of the Savage Nation. And I know how it goes. I mean, you know, people go away, and I'm not the same number of people listen in the summer. I understand all that. But I've always worked during the summer, you know, a week here, a week there, because I've always written a lot in the summer. I like the summer. It's a relaxed pace. I tell more stories. I tend to be less tense. I'm not as filled with angst, you know. So I find the pace a lot nicer on the radio. I find it wonderful to be on the radio in the summer. The people are more relaxed. I'm more relaxed. But I want to tell you that I finished the book that I've been working on for a long time on Saturday night at 11:30 at night. I'm almost blind from it. And what it is, it's not so much my autobiography. You know what it is? It's all the stories that I've told on the radio that are worth printing. It's funny, it's a takeoff of the New York Times, all the news that's fit to print. These are all the stories that were fit to print, and they're my stories. You know, One-Armed Frank, Fat Al's Tuna. Some of them you've heard. Some have appeared in different form in some of my previous books. But I've got doozies in there you never heard. Maybe once on this show. And I'm not going to sell it right now. It's not ready. It's not going to the printer yet. I want you to know what I was doing over the weekend. And, you know, dwelling on your past is not easy. Like when I go back and I have to re-edit stories I told on this show, like my first autopsy, my first corpse, you know, Barney the Undertaker. It's depressing in a way because it's hard to relive this stuff. You know, you want to move forward. You don't necessarily want to live in the past. I don't want to turn to a pillar of salt. But anyway, these are some of the stories. And if you want to go to michaelsavage.com with me, we'll do that before the break and see what the other stories are. Blind Special Forces soldier determined to serve. That's a beautiful story. Newspapers bracing for more bad news. Obama stooge attacks McCain. That's Wesley Clark. Along with $4 gas, many luxuries are going down the tank. And it's a story about what you are penny pinching in your life, like dinners out, coffee runs, trips to the ball game are down. Hmm. Former Abu Ghraib detainees sue U.S. contractors. I guess they got a good shyster lawyer out of New York. Somebody from Brooklyn named Hoavi. Some Hoavi who loves America so much that he can't wait to sue. That's what they taught you? That's what your ancestors taught you, Hoavi? That's what they lived through, all of that horror, that you could come to this country and in two generations put a knife in its back, Hoavi? Hoavi, if you had any brains, you'd have a heart. I'll be right back, Hoavi.
Savage.
That large squadron in the air, in the Navy that he commanded, it wasn't a wartime squadron. He hasn't been there and ordered the bombs to fall. He hasn't seen what it's like when diplomats come in and say, I don't know whether we're going to be able to get this point through or not. Do you want to take the risk? What about your reputation? How do we handle it publicly? He hasn't made those calls. Well, I don't think riding in a fighter plane and getting shot down is a qualification to be president.
Well, I don't think dropping bombs on innocent civilians, Mr. Clark, is a qualification to even open your mouth. Frankly, there are many, many people in the world who think you're a war criminal. So if you want to start saying that John McCain isn't qualified to be president, what are you qualified to be if you bombed innocent civilians who were not even involved in a war? You killed them, 2,700, according to the UN. You killed 2,700 innocent Serbian men, women, and children. You bombed trains, planes. You bombed railway stations. You bombed schools. You bombed mental hospitals. You blew up every bridge on the Danube River. There are people who say that you did it. So now you're boasting about it, sir? You know, people really ought to look into Wesley Clark's background. But I don't think you will get it. That's the problem. So when I say newspapers are in decline, you know, that's bad news in a way and good news in a way. It's good news that they're in decline. Maybe they'll keep the better reporters. Maybe there's a hope that they'll wake up to the fact that they're alienating the one core base of newspaper buyers who are predominantly white people over the age of 50 who are heterosexual and married. If you study the demographics of newspaper readers, it is primarily white, married, heterosexual people. And they're largely center-right people. They don't want to read about a lesbian parade in San Francisco. They get disgusted looking at it. Their stomach turns. They're sick of the word pride associated with homosexuality. They're sick of seeing the enemy celebrated and the military vilified. They are sick and tired of seeing the church and religion spat upon by the atheist. I don't have to go down the litany. You know what I'm talking about. The newspapers could still be saved. Oh, they'll have to retrench. They'll have to cut back for sure. But if you gave me a job to run a newspaper, I've told you this for 3 years now, two, 3 years. I'm not looking for a job. I'm just telling you that I know what to do to save any major newspaper in any city. I know exactly what to do to sell newspapers. Hey, you in the newspaper business, you think you know more than me? My show has grown. Your papers have shrunk. Why? Because I'm selling a newspaper. I'm selling an oral newspaper here on the Savage Nation. I know what the people want to read. You don't. You're out of touch with reality. And that's because you're writing your newspapers not for the customer, but for your boyfriend or your girlfriend. And that's why your papers are dying. And that's the truth. That's the bottom line on it all. And that's just one big story, but it's all tied in together here. You know, it's all tied in together. Now, I want to read you something. Here is a list. I'm going to read you some titles of editorials or monologues I've written over the last several months. Oil for War. Remember that one? For years, I've been calling for Iraq to pay us back for the cost of liberating them from the torture chambers of Saddam Hussein. You remember that? Hey, how's that for a newspaper editorial? How about the one from last week? Bush's legacy, the greatest American president. Why did I say that? Because last Thursday, we won on the Second Amendment. Why did we win? Because Bush put in two conservatives in the Supreme Court. The seven plagues of the United States, where I said God is angry with the United States. Do you remember my brilliant analysis of Republicans versus conservatives? That's another one of my editorials. How about the real Ted Kennedy? When everybody was boo-hoo-hooing over Ted Kennedy, I was the only one in the media who had the guts to remember Ted Kennedy's true legacy. I was attacked for that. But just because he got sick doesn't mean that his legacy disappeared with his illness. How about the sellout of the white male, June 30th, 2008? You want me to read you some of the other headlines that I wrote on my verbal newspaper? They'd make for a heck of a book. Heroes versus humanity. Heroes versus humanity. Anchors away, attacking the anchor babies in America, June 30th, 2000. Oh, that's today, June 30th. What am I talking about? That's the date on today. The Unfairness Doctrine by Michael Savage. I explained to you why it's not the Fairness Doctrine at all. It's Mussolini in work. Mussolini in a skirt with bad rouge. Mussolini, if he came back and wore ugly clothing and put on bad makeup and had too much Botox, he would be calling for the Fairness Doctrine, assuming he would still own the winery and the bad restaurant chain. Now, there are many other stories that we can talk about, and they're all up on michaelsavage.com, as well as other stories. I have not yet canceled the New York Times. And it's not that it's a great paper. It's because I'm addicted to my past. I've been reading that paper since I'm 17. First job, stained raincoat with a tuna fish stain on the raincoat from taking it to work. My lunch was the stained tuna fish sandwich, or the tuna fish sandwich that stained my trench coat, with the New York Times, and I'd buy a cup of tea and a little luncheonette on a rainy day. Of course, it's not the same paper, and I'm not the same man. But inside, I'm still Michael Savage. How about you?
Savage.
...1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com, the oral newspaper of the day. Now, how come this newspaper, this oral newspaper, the Savage Nation, is thriving? And it is. And print newspapers are declining. Why is that? You say, well, it's old media. Well, they're old media. I'm old media, right? How old am I? I mean, what do you mean old media? The news is the news. The ability to deliver it properly and have an opinion and deliver it with some verve or entertainment value is quite a story unto itself. Is it that the newspapers are no longer entertaining in their delivery? They're static and a guy like me is entertaining. I mix things up. I don't really have that answer, but I know that the policy, the social policies of too many of the writers is what's alienating the reader. Why would you buy a paper like that? So as I closed off in the last hour, it's a loss for all of us to see the papers go out of business. What are we going to do when we have less reportage? I mean, I wouldn't mind if they shrank 10, 20% and had kept some of the real reporters who were objective instead of being stooges for Obama and the left wing and the gay agenda. Never mind. The number one is the gay agenda. The single biggest reason that newspapers exist today is to push the gay agenda, to the best of my knowledge. The second biggest reason is to push the illegal alien agenda. The third biggest reason they get up in the morning is to push Obama's agenda. Other than that, they have no reason to exist. So, you know, I'm going through a lot of stuff today. I don't even know. I don't know how to say this in a way that doesn't alienate anybody, but I had planned on being off for most of this month because of a medical thing. I'm going to tell you about that in a minute. I'm perfectly fine, but I'll tell you what happened. I may take a week or two or this or that, you know, just to take a break. Then I can tell you that I'm in intense. To this second, I do not know which station I'm going to be on tomorrow in the San Francisco Bay Area. I can say that without offending anybody. It's absolutely true. To this second, I've been in contract negotiations continuously for about a couple of months. And if you've seen, well, you haven't heard it because I'm a professional, but I'm, to this day, to this second, I don't know what station I'm on tomorrow to show you the nature of the business and what they'll do to talent to try to lowball them. That's what the business has become today. It's not what it was even a few years ago. They think that a talent is a commodity, like a bushel of wheat. They don't understand that we're human beings and we remember things. But I'm not a complainer. I can get angry, but I'm not a complainer. Third, I was going to have a colonoscopy, which I was supposed to have last June and canceled. Listen to this one. I did some research on the internet, and it's exactly everything I feared about colonoscopies again. I have no symptoms, you know, nothing wrong, blah, blah, blah. But every you got to get it, you got to get it, you got to get it, blah, 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 blah. Well, I'm not Katie Couric, okay? So I start to do some research, and it's every bit of my medical intuition was correct. Cross-contamination with a dirty probe. You want me to go into detail or I have to spell it out for you? How about organic matter on the probe they stick into your body? Now, ask you, how often does it happen? I don't know how often does it happen. You're going to tell me you're sure that the $8 an hour employee from some illegal alien nation that cleaned the probe that went into your butt that came out of someone else was autoclave clean? Or you're going to tell me there may be some organic matter from the patient or the patients who preceded you over the last days or weeks? How do you know? What, your doctor? The man whose grandfather told you to smoke Chesterfields because they were good for your T-zone? Your doctor is going to tell you that it's perfectly safe. Don't believe the crackpots? I don't want to take a chance of having a guy with hepatitis had it put into his guts and then take it out and give it to the guy from God knows where, Stan, the $9 an hour guy who should be working in a morgue, and he runs it under hot water instead of autoclaving it. And by the way, they don't autoclave the equipment. They do not autoclave. It's the only way to be sure you're not getting a contamination. So in Europe, they use a sleeve on these instruments, on the equivalent of a condom, if you want to get into the details, that reduce the risk of cross-contamination to a large extent. But the camera tip is still exposed. Now, how clean is that? We don't know. But the Euros are ahead of us on this. Maybe the HMO said, no, you can't use any disposable instruments. We want to save money. So take it from the guy who has hepatitis B and give it to the healthy one and tell him, oh, you're fine. We found nothing. And then 3 months later, the guy has hepatitis B for unknown reasons. Then you go back to the same quack will put you on a medicine that'll blow your kidneys out. And speaking of blowing your kidneys out, what about the purgatives that they make you take, the great men of the colonoscopy field, who tell you to take these high phosphorus purgatives to clean out your intestinal tract? You do know that some folks have had kidney damage from high phosphorus laxatives because they did not intake enough liquid, and they wound up with phosphate deposits in their kidneys, and some have needed kidney transplants. That's enough for me. I've had enough. I couldn't even get the doctor to call me back. I called the office 4 times last week. I said, I got to ask the doctor a few questions. Oh, we don't do that here. We don't provide that service in this clinic. Just come in and lay down, put your butt in the air, and let us stick it in you, moron. You're just a chicken. You're a Purdue chicken to us. We got to get these procedures, as many as possible, in order to get billable hours. That's it. No more. No colonoscopy. So I have a friend of a friend who runs a virtual colonoscopy clinic. Very nice man. And I said to him, tell me about the virtual colonoscopy. He said, well, we do it, but you still have to put a wire in the colon. I said, he said, wait 6 months. He said, we're about to launch a totally non-invasive colonoscopy. No purgatives necessary, no laxatives, and no insertion whatsoever. I said, okay. I said, make me the guinea pig. I'll talk about it on the radio show. So that's what I'm going to do in December. That's all. This is like the way of the dodo, this. I looked into the camera, the pill camera that an Israeli invented, where you swallow a pill and it goes through your body and projects two frames per second in real-time pictures. Unbelievable genius. Apparently it doesn't work in the colon. It works in the intestine. So we're very close to dispensing with this entire technology, this primitive technology, as it were, rife with potentials for cross-contamination and kidney damage for a certain number of the population. And that's it. I'm not doing it. So that's number one. That's A. And then the other thing is B. You heard about B already. And what else? Worked on the book. Got a migraine for 2 days now from the book. The eyes hurt. What would you like to talk about? I have callers, like all the 10 lines are lit up here. It's the summertime. Hey, wait, but let me take a deep breath. Okay, everybody breathe in. Breathe in. Breathe out. Good. I took a deep breath. Smell the roses. Smell the coffee. I need some summertime music. Usually around July 1st, I shift into summertime modality. I have every year, and I do wonderful, beautiful, happy shows. For me, I enjoy it tremendously. All of my life, I used to work better in the summer than any time else.
Summertime.
I don't like that. No, it's too not me. It's not me. I got to think of another song that provokes summer for me, and I know what it is. And then I'm going to tell the story to go with it. But I'm going to offer a prize. When you hear the following song, I want you to tell me which Savage story is connected with it and which story I'm going to tell. But here's the story. Here's the song. It's the Shabup Shabup song. It's the Shabup Shabup song. I want you to play.
My love must be a kind of blind love. I can't see anyone but you.
Shabup Shabup. Shabup Shabup. Shabup Shabup.
All right, let's stop right here. Who's going to win the prize? What story is associated with Shabup Shabup? I only have eyes for you. What story is Michael Savage going to tell from his past that will be in his Savage storybook? Whoever gets this right wins a prize immediately. The prize will not be my dog, Teddy. Incidentally, I have a 4-year-old gray poodle who I love more than I should. And I don't know what I'm going to do. And I don't even want to with the ashes and the box. Don't want to. But I want to mate him. So I'm looking now for a wife for him. I become like the grandfathers in New York that I used to know. I used to laugh at them. They run into a girl and they'd say, I got a grandson for you. You should only meet him. I say, that's embarrassing, man. You're insulting your grandson. No, she's a nice girl from a good family. Keep your don't know what you're talking about. So I become like that with a dog now. I'm looking for a perfect, like, 2 to 4-year-old gray poodle with good papers. And we'll split the litter. We'll split the litter because I got to keep reproducing this dog. Like the son of Teddy, the son of Teddy's son, the son of Teddy's son. No, I do. I want to have Teddy's forever. I don't know how I'm going to live without this guy. I had so many dogs. I'm getting, like, silly as I get older. I've always liked my dogs. I never wept over them, truthfully. I mean, the first one, Tippy, got thrown in the garbage truck. That's in the book, too. Tippy dies and gets thrown in a garbage truck. I mean, you talk about, I lived in a black and white, like, Polish reality, even though I'm not Polish. Like, if there was a movie made in Warsaw in black and white, about my childhood, it could not be shot in color. My childhood is like a black and white film noir. You know what I'm saying? It's like double. I mean, they have to shoot it in a certain dark black and white on top of it all. Very muted. Hardly any light in it. And that wouldn't be a bad movie because I'm going to do the movie after the book, I decided. I slowed down the movie project. I figured I'm going to do the book first, then the movie. I'm not like, what do I have to rush everything for? What? I had the best... Can I back up now and tell you something? We don't have to talk about Wesley Clark and McCain. We know Clark's a first-class yuck. And we know that comparison to him, McCain is a much better man. That we know. So Clark just shot himself in the foot by his big mouth. He can never be the running mate now for Obama. His entire political machinations have come to nothing. That's the business he's in, and so am I. It's like a one-line business. One wrong line and you're out of business. He just did his one line. He just lost his political career. Wesley Clark is now radioactive. He's U-235, and I don't mean a German boat. San Francisco, we have a winner. Michael, go ahead. What story goes with Shabup Shabup?
Michael, it's a story about the young girl that was brought home to the father after a night of being with some boys that kind of took advantage of her, I think.
No, I'm sorry. That's not the Nymphomaniac at Alley Pond Park story. Although that is a good story that I left out of the book, for God's sakes. Man, now I have to go and write that story now for the book. I forgot it already. That's not in the book, Michael. How do you remember that?
You know what? I don't know. I guess I just listen to you too much, but your stories are very captivating, and I could totally envision what was going through and how it must have made the father feel and the empathy that I felt for him. And
that is an amazing story. The nymphomaniac after the boys got through with her. What a story that is. It broke. I got sick from it.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe that. That's really got me sick. It just shows you that a lot of guys don't care, you know. Should I tell that story again about the nympho in Alley Pond Park?
I personally think it's a worthwhile story. I mean, it really hits home to a lot of guys.
Okay, Michael, I'm going to send you a gift anyway. I'm sending you a free copy of my DVD, okay? Will that work for you?
Michael, you're awesome. Thank you. Yes.
Yes, you got it. Stay on the line. Guys, get the name, send it to my fulfillment house in Florida, and he gets a free copy of the Freedom of Speech DVD, the most important speech given in radio in the last 25 years, bar none. Michael Savage's Freedom of Speech. The speech that C-SPAN banned, that the great man Brian Lamb, the mini-me Lamb, wouldn't run. But he's nothing. No one even knows who he is. So, oh, I do have a winner. It's from Gulfport, Mississippi. Gina, welcome. This is a winner. You got it. Hold it. Let's set it up again. Play Shabup Shabup for about 30 seconds.
My love must be a kind of blind love.
All right, let's pause. Gina, what story goes with this song? Go ahead, please.
It was a very romantic tale of you and a young girl near the sewer treatment plant.
You win. That's right. Love, first love at the sewer treatment plant.
I know.
Well, wait. Why do you remember that? I mean, that's a tough one. I gave people the toughest possible song story connection I could come up with. How did you figure that out?
That was what my boyfriend said. We were sitting here listening, and I said, you said, tell the story. And I said, that's the girl by the sewer treatment plant. He said, how
well,
do you know?
Well, you just went, okay, I'm sending you a free copy of my Freedom of Speech DVD. Would you like that, Gina, because you got it?
That's great.
That's it. See, Gulfport, Mississippi, and all the smart people in the Porn Belt, New York, Washington, D.C., oh, the Porn Belt sophisticates are coming home from the gay and lesbian parade, you know. They're just dragging themselves home now, taking off the soiled outfits. Oh, they could laugh at these stories. But the real America loves Michael Savage. And the real America will be here having the last laugh long after the Porn Belt cretins are gone. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Here are two articles on MichaelSavage.com. Obama stooge Wesley Clark attacks McCain's military service. That you heard. But underneath it is something you probably will not see as a follow-up except in my newspaper, which is the radio show, and my printed version, which is the website. And that is this article from another group called Real Change. It's this. Is Wesley Clark's war record all we thought it was? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He wants to start trying to slowboat McCain? Mm-hmm. Well, we'll join in the fray. Let us slowboat Wesley Clark now. Let's look into old Wesley Clark's history. Some think he's a war criminal for killing 2,500 innocent Serbs. He says he's the man who launched the bombs. But I don't even want to waste my time. I don't know him. I don't know McCain. You know, to me, they're all the same at a certain point. They're all, power-mad politicians, honestly. Now, if they put their country above their desire for fame, I'd be very happy to say I would vote for them. Thus far, I haven't seen that. But let me tell the story that song went with, which is the Love by the Sewer Plant. No, I told that one. The Nympho at Alley Pond Park. I have 3 minutes and 13 seconds. What a life radio is. The normal life, I wouldn't have I'm looking at a clock. End of show in 3 minutes and seven, 3 minutes and six, 3 minutes and five. Who lives like this? Me. In a normal life, you get ready to set up a story. You got people hanging around. You have a drink. You're sitting around. There's no time to it. It's a timeless story. 2 minutes now, 52 seconds. I can't live this way anymore. I can't take it. 2:49, 2:47. I don't know if I have enough time. I'll start the story. So you see, I was about 16 years old, Queens, New York. And one of the girls in the crowd was, well, she was that way. She was an infomaniac. It was a cold winter's evening. A group of five or six guys took her in a car to Alley Pond Park, and they had their way with her. I was one of the guys in the car, and I did not want my way with her. In fact, I felt bad for her. I didn't know what to do. I was like, I was the idiot, sensitive kid in the back who was laughed at. Like, hey, it's your turn. I said, no, I just don't want to do this. Something's wrong here. So after the guys, these pigs, these animals, most of whom wound up working in the garment center, selling clothing. Some, I think, went into the television business. One went into the record business. Got through with her. The car went back to her house. And here's the whole crux of the story. It's not like laughing about the nymphomaniac in the car. Here's the crux of the story. Car pulls up back in front of her house. And she lived in a nice house. And her father's waiting for her on the lawn of the house with an overcoat. The guys basically throw her out of the car, disheveled and like half naked, laughing, and speed away. And I turn around and see the father walking up to her to cloak her and cover her nakedness with the overcoat. Now, there's so much in that story that needs to be discussed. I don't have the time for it. I have a minute and 15 seconds. What a father. What a great father he was. Now, you'd think a father would scream, you filthy slut, you, blah, 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 how dare you? Or he'd come at the car and hit the guys. He didn't do either, did he? He lived with what was. He knew who his daughter was and what her proclivities were. I don't know how she wound up. I mean, maybe she turns out. A lot of people go through these phases, and they, you know, in the woman's side, you know, can straighten out. I mean, I don't know what they become. Maybe a yoga instructor or something later on in life, or if they're a male and they suffer from satiriasis, they become a president, like Bill Clinton. You know, if they suffer the equivalent of nymphomania in male, it's satiriasis, and that can make you into a wonderful president in some cases. But in either case, that's the story of the nymphomaniac at Alley Pond Park. That goes with the song which we're going to play right now on the way out this hour, the Only Have Eyes For You song, Springland, New York. Oh, no, wait a minute. Play the song. But that goes with the girl next to the sewer plant.
I can't see anyone.
That's right. That was a runner-up to Nympho story. I don't know what song goes with that.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Large squadron in the air, in the Navy that he commanded, it wasn't a wartime squadron. He hasn't been there and ordered the bombs to fall. He hasn't seen what it's like when diplomats come in and say, I don't know whether we're going to be able to get this point through or not. Do you want to take the risk? What about your reputation? How do we handle it publicly? He hasn't made those calls. Well, I don't think riding in a fighter plane and getting shot down is a qualification to be president. But
Blue Monday, how are you? Got to work, flag or sleeve on deep. Here come Tuesday, oh Tuesday. I'm so tired, got no time to play.
Well, I don't think riding in a fighter plane and getting shot down is a qualification to be president. But
well, I don't think slowboating yourself on national television is a qualification to be a vice president, Mr. Clark. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. This is one story of many. We're also talking about satiriasis, which is the male equivalent of nymphomania. That came up in passing, but it's an interesting topic that we shouldn't immediately dismiss, because today's images of sexually available women, which of course is the only image that is permitted to be portrayed by the homosexuals who permeate our culture with the images is that of the sexually available woman. When have they last shown you a woman who was not sexually available other than to mock her? So the only image of a woman that is projected today is that of a sexually promiscuous woman. And that is, of course, because homosexuals are largely, not solely, but largely in charge of the image-making business, particularly with regard to models. And so they continue to seek the younger and younger looking slut look. Whether or not the women are that way doesn't matter. What matters is that they ape the homosexual lifestyle. And so, therefore, the image of the sexually available woman today, which would once have been seen as slutty or nymphomaniacal, is today considered the norm. And any woman who does not comport herself that way is considered out of it. But in the 19th century, doctors treated nymphomania as an organic disease. So, therefore, 99% of the women on television, let's say on Fox News, even the ones who wear crosses, would have been treated by Dr. Freud. Because it's, in other words, what is the look today? The lipstick, the rouge, the leg crossing, the short skirts. It works. I mean, they know it works. We're all human. We're not made of stone. But the women in the news business today would have been treated for an organic disease by Sigmund Freud. Today, psychologists and psychoanalysts have looked to low self-esteem or an unresolved Oedipal complex to explain nymphomania. Of course, nymphomania is hardly discussed at all. When have you last heard the word nymphomania? Kinsey the fraud, the sex fraud, claimed that a nymphomaniac was simply someone who has more sex than you do. But Kinsey himself was a psycho. He was a sicko who made up his own data. But young guys today actually use the word nympho in a positive way. I don't know if you know that. A lot of young guys refer to women who are like fun to be with as nymphos. Of course, in my day, you know, you thought that a girl like that was given Spanish fly. You know, I used to read the Man magazines. I forget the names of some of these magazines. There were magazines called, you know, like Male, Bronco. I don't know what they're like men magazines. They weren't nudie magazines. They were like stories for men. You know, guys who wore like wool shirts in the summer. Like rough fabric, not that sissified fabric. They didn't need 600-count sheet like I do on a vacation. Men who slept on anything, whatever, raw burlap. I'm a man. Breaking an egg. I don't care. Rip out my arteries. Put in pig arteries. I don't care about no sissy heart attack. The Male magazine. Most of them were probably doing each other for all I know. You know, that overly macho thing. We know what that really is. We've all grown up. We know what the overly macho story really is. We understand all of that. But in my day, Spanish Fly, they wrote about in the men magazines. I was 13. All I wanted to do was get a vial of Spanish Fly. My friends, there was no internet then. My friends and I searched like madmen. See, where could you buy Spanish Fly? Went to Doc's pharmacy. Hey, Doc, you got any Spanish? No one ever heard of it. Allegedly, it was like, I don't know. But anyway, Spanish Fly made them, you know, go crazy. But what about female sexual addiction? That's certainly part of the therapist vocabulary today. It's an interesting topic. It really is. And I don't know if you want to talk about it. Is this worth talking about? Many of you don't want some to get embarrassed. All right, we've had a sexual revolution in this country. We know that. And everybody listening to the show has been affected by it one way or the other. And surely the sexual revolution that we've all lived through has not eliminated a double standard. Men still think that women who do as much as they do are somehow devoid of their character. You know, the man could do it with as many as they want, and he's a macho guy. If she does it, she's lower than him. But, I mean, why should it be that way? Has virginity lost its singular importance? Do women today... are they happier than their mothers? Now, that's the real important. With all the sex, are they happier than their mother's generation? Really, they are, huh? Get back to me when they're 40. Get back to me when you drive around Marin County and take a look at the women over 40 without a husband, without children. Get back to me when they've lost their sexual vitality and they can't get a mate. Well, sure, then they marry their roommate and they go in the parade yesterday. I understand that. That's all that's left for them. And you know something? I'm not against that when you come right down to it. I mean, love like that is better than nothing, to be honest with you. That's all a person could have. It's better than being untouched for the last 50 years of your life. What do you think? You're going to get a special place in heaven that after you lost your sexual appeal, you never were touched again for 60 years? So you got a special place in heaven waiting for you. Gold shares. Yeah. So if no guy wants you and you got someone else whose husband ditched him for a younger man, well, all right. I'll split the baby there with the bathwater on that one. So I don't know if you want to talk about happy nymphos or unhappy nymphos or the sexual revolution. What about other perversions, quote-unquote perversions? Like in my days, there were perversions. Today, they're not even considered perversions. You're considered an Eagle Scout if you engage in fetishism, masochism. Oh, yeah. There's a merit badge for masochism in San Francisco amongst the judges. And I understand they're working on a new merit badge in the mayor's office for necrophilia. Certainly sadism and satyriasis are qualifications to become a politician in California, that we know. Voyeurism is a given. Without that, you don't even get a Cub Scout badge in the city of San Francisco. But I believe they're working on a new merit badge for necrophilia in the mayor's office in order to make sure they can appoint a necrophiliac to the highest office in the city. Anyway, here we are, 1-800-449-8255. Orlando, Florida. Raphael, go ahead. You're on the Savage Nation.
I agree wholeheartedly with General Wesley Clark. I think, unfortunately, some people are going to dismiss his comments as some guy who's jealous.
Yeah, but wait. I understand you're an Obama supporter, but Wesley Clark himself killed 2,600 innocent men, women, and children in Serbia, people who were not combatants in a war. So if you want to talk about Wesley Clark, why don't you talk about the whole picture of Wesley Clark?
You can't run on just, I was held hostage. It's not qualification.
Well, again, you're not listening. You're calling because you work for Obama. You've got a script. They've sent it out from central headquarters in Chicago. If you're not willing to discuss the man who made these claims, then you're not capable of a discussion. And if you're not capable of a discussion, we have nothing more to say to each other.
I'm not. You don't know anything about me.
Well, I don't want to know anything about you. That's the first rule of talk radio. I'm not interested in you. I'm interested in your ideas. That's all that matters. Wesley Clark is not the war hero he portrays himself to be. And frankly, whether you accept it or not, Wesley Clark has just disqualified himself for being a vice presidential candidate. In fact, Obama's distanced himself from Wesley Clark. I'm surprised that you're still supporting Wesley Clark.
He's more qualified than McCain.
Who is?
General Clark.
He's more qualified than McCain, but he's not running for anything.
But you're trying to say...
Whoa. Wesley Clark is a non-entity. He's not running for anything, sir. He tried to see if he could gain favor with Obama by attacking McCain. What happened was Obama was disgusted by it because of the backlash. So what you're saying has no validity. What matters here is did he make political points or not? He shot himself in the foot, number one, and all he did was create sympathy for McCain, number two. And number three, even Obama has distanced himself from these remarks. How can you say that McCain is not qualified to be a commander-in-chief and Obama is? So if you say that flying a jet and leading a squadron is not a qualification, tell me what running an activist group in Chicago makes you.
And he told the truth. You just don't have the courage.
Again. Are you sitting there and saying that flying a jet and suffering for 5 years at the hands of the Vietnamese torturers is not heroic?
That is not enough qualifications to be president.
All right. That's not enough. Okay, hold on. Flying a jet, leading a naval squadron, suffering through 5 years of torture is not enough qualification. Fine. So therefore, someone who has less qualification than that is more qualified?
The thing is, Mike, it's...
Why don't you tell me the name of the squadron that Obama flew in?
He has no military experience.
Thank you. You're right. Obama has no military expertise. You've made my point. So if you're disqualifying McCain, how can you now qualify Obama, who never served in the military?
Didn't.
Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. We'll be right back.
Savage.
Dr. Savage, sir, please, you're back, sir. Dr. Savage?
Okay, Michael Savage here. They put bathrooms in radio stations as far from the broadcast area as they can possibly locate them. And you're told you got 72 seconds till you're back on the air, but nature calls. I mean, what are you going to do here? You're a human being. They think that we're a commodity like a bushel of wheat, but we're not. We're human beings. Can they put the bathrooms closer to the studio? I'm going to wind up needing like what they used on World War II airplanes if this keeps up. But the big story of the day is not Satyriasis, but the stupidity of Wesley Clark. And all this is provoked is by Wesley Clark saying that riding in a fighter plane, getting shot down are not qualifications for being a president, has opened up the entire question of, oh, really, so that doesn't qualify John McCain? What, running an activist unit in Chicago in the streets giving out flyers is? Don't you understand what this did to Obama's campaign? Phil, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Well, all I can say is these guys must be terribly poorly educated, because it seems to me we had a president of the United States once who had a patrol torpedo boat shot out from under him in the Blackett Straits off of New Guinea. We had a president of the United States that flew a torpedo bomber over Aishima and got shot down, picked up by a U.S. submarine. He was a president of the United States. So Wesley Clark, who said...
Wait, hold on. So you're saying riding in a fighter plane, getting shot down is a qualification. You're talking about JFK and who else?
And George Bush at first.
Oh, my God. You're right. And, of course, JFK had his torpedo boat shot out from underneath him. I didn't hear anyone when he ran for office saying, well, Bashar riding in a torpedo boat in the middle of action and getting shot out is no qualification. Nobody would have dared say that. What is wrong with Wesley Clark, Phil? And I know you know him.
Yeah, and I've known him for years. It's a terrible situation. I mean, it's a low step and a very sad thing. The man is infected with overarching ambition that I think clouds his judgment. And to make a comment like that is just appalling, just appalling.
Well, don't you think that, A, it's created sympathy for McCain, B, it's shown Obama to have absolutely no military experience by comparison?
Yeah, right on both counts. I absolutely do. If you look at people who have been in the military, who are serving in the military today, overwhelmingly, they back John McCain.
Well, for good reason. Even though he's wishy-washy on too many issues, at the end of the day, we know one thing. Nobody can question his loyalty to the United States of America, which is a lot more than we can say about the suspicious unknown character, Barack Hussein Obama, who has many, many, many holes in his background that have never been filled other than with hot air.
Guys,
thanks for the call, Phil. Up next is a military-related story, and that is amazing how it fits here. I'd rather talk about nymphomania right now, but we are going to talk about the military situation with Michael Scheuer. Michael Scheuer is an ex-CIA operative, and he's going to talk about what went wrong in Pakistan in the war on terror, and what I guess the Bush administration could have done and didn't do, or what they should do and are not doing. Because we know that we read that President Bush wants to get Osama bin Laden before his term is up. I mean, I wish he does. Truthfully, you cut the head of the snake, and the snake is left to wriggle and die. And there's no question that they haven't gotten him. So until he shows up, we got time for one more call on the show in this segment. That'll be on nymphomania, because it's more interesting than Wesley Clark and the CIA and Osama bin Laden put together. San Diego, Diana, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, I'm concerned that our nation is selling our children short, and all the diseases that we're being.
Of course they are. You see little girls 12 years old dressing up like mini harlots because they see the pop stars performing and aping harlots, Jezebels in the biblical time, and the little girls think that to be cool, they've got to be a slut. We read that they're sending naked pictures of themselves at 8 or 9 years old. Where is this coming from? How does it stop?
Well, and then we have TV commercials where they're, you know, encouraging people to have sex with people who have diseases.
Yeah, herpes. Oh, you have herpes? Fine, just take this drug and go and have more sex. You hear? You didn't learn from the first shot. Go get more. Now maybe you can get AIDS to go with it. No, I know that. It's astounding what the medical pharmaceutical profession has become. But what is what it was? Tell me what is what it was. Nothing is the same. You know, I talked about the pill camera earlier, where you digest it. It takes 2 frames per second in real time as it transits through your bowel. I realize that that might be the ultimate test for a politician. Follow my logic. The next time a politician gives a speech, he will have had to have ingested a pill camera several hours earlier, And we could watch on a video screen as it transits his bowel, and we could see just how full of you-know-what that politician is as the pill camera transits his inner landscape. That's Michael Savage's view. Give all the politicians a pill camera and make them give a real-time speech so we the people can see just how full of it they really are.
Savage.
We will get back to these absurd attacks on John McCain by Obama's minions and how they're backfiring not only on the minions like Wesley Clark, who has now permanently destroyed his political career as far as I'm concerned, but they're destroying Obama, and I'll tell you why. It's because you're saying that flying a fighter jet, leading a squadron, getting shot down and being a POW for 5 years does not qualify you for commander-in-chief. Well, okay. Maybe that's true. So having no military experience, as Obama does not have any experience, qualifies you more? Don't you see how absurd this is? This is an example of the juvenile behavior and attitudes of not only the advisors around Obama, but Obama himself, who looks like a jerk to me. The more I see this guy, he looks like a jerk, big ears, and doesn't know what he's talking about, but he's got a great voice and a great presence till you look carefully. The guy is so green, it's unbelievable to me. And I mean that in three ways. Now we're going to go to another story. We heard a lot this week about Bush blowing it in Pakistan. Didn't get Osama bin Laden. The Al-Qaeda is stronger in the tribal areas than they were when the war started. Michael Scheuer served in the CIA for 22 years. I guess that qualifies him to know something about counterintelligence. I realize it's not as good as sitting in your pajamas and typing a blog, but he served for 22 years in the CIA. He was the chief of the Bin Laden unit at the Counterterrorist Center from 96 to 99. And he has written several books, including Marching Towards Hell. Michael Scheuer, welcome to the Savage Nation. I should say, welcome back to the Savage Nation.
Thank you very much, sir. You're very kind to have me back.
Well, Michael, look, you served 22 years in the CIA, so people could say to you, if you served as the chief of the Bin Laden unit, why were you not able to get him? Now, you told me on this show that you had him, that your agency, your group, rather, had Bin Laden in their sights several times. Correct or incorrect?
10 times, sir.
Here we go. Here's the answer. So 10 times you had him in the sights. You could have knocked him out with what kind of weaponry?
Twice we could have captured him using assets of the Central Intelligence Agency, and 8 times we could have killed him using air assets of the U.S. military, sir.
That's a very clear answer. The man answered America straight up. No double talk. If you gave Michael Scheuer a pill camera, you'd get a straight answer. If you gave John Kerry a pill camera, you'd see nothing but dark imagery. So, Michael, continuing along these lines, it was Bill Clinton who said, don't shoot, right?
Absolutely, sir. That's correct.
Okay. So now, under George Bush, have they had equal opportunity to get Bin Laden?
They really haven't, sir. They had one chance in December of 2001 at Tora Bora, and they chose not to do it. We had any number of soldiers willing to go in there into those mountains and get him, but the generals were afraid of losing people, and so they hired people who used to fight alongside Bin Laden to go get him.
Oh, that's like hiring members of a drug cartel to go get the leader of the drug cartel.
Exactly, sir. That's exactly correct.
Well, who would make a decision like that? Are they that naive? Who are these people?
Well, you know, so many of our generals have never been really military people. They've been bureaucrats. And they were looking at Bin Laden was in a very tough terrain. They would have lost a lot of soldiers going in there, and they decided that they wanted to not hurt public opinion. And so they sent in people who really were more loyal to Bin Laden than they were to anything else.
Well, at least it looked good on paper. They were at least spending the hundreds of millions they were budgeted. You know, that's the important thing.
I think that's right sometimes, sir.
But, Michael, let's be serious here. Why can't the intelligence community get its act together with respect to tracking down Al-Qaeda leaders in Afghanistan and Pakistan? What is the real problem?
Well, I think the real problem, sir, is not so much the problem of intelligence, is the problem of not having enough resources in Afghanistan. It's a country bigger than Texas. We have 40,000 people there. We send soldiers and Marines overseas now who are more targets than they are killers, because we don't want to kill anybody unless we're absolutely certain who the enemy is. And so at the end of the day, we are really, we're like policemen, not a military organization.
And so George Bush has followed very well in Bill Clinton's footsteps of creating an international police force and, in essence, taking out the fighting spirit of the U.S. Marines in particular, with his continuous persecution of Marines who have done their job a little too well, as an example by Colonel Cesani, who I've defended on this show repeatedly. I don't want to get sidetracked. Let's again focus, if we can, on al-Qaeda in Pakistan. What went wrong?
We, sir, still live in our leadership class in the Cold War. We thought we were going to find a proxy named General Musharraf who was going to do all of our dirty work for us. And from the very start, it was clear that he would help us, but he would not destroy his own nation to do our dirty work. And so for the past 7 years, we have been waiting for something that was never going to happen, and that's depending on someone else to take care of America. And Mr. Bush has been just as guilty of this as Mr. Clinton was.
Mm-hmm. And it's unlikely to change whether it's McCain or Obama, by what I hear. The bureaucracy is so entrenched that we're going to go along exactly the way we've been going along, or is there a difference in your estimation?
I don't think there's a lick of difference, sir. I think the political leadership in both parties is much more interested in being recognized as citizens of the world than they are as being citizens of the United States.
I see. So they don't want to upset anybody by killing several civilians along with the terrorist, the arch-terrorist leader. So that leaves us in quite a pickle. Therefore, we're going to get hit again. Is that your estimation?
I think without a doubt, sir.
Wait, let me take a deep breath. Without a doubt, sir? You really believe they have operatives here who are ready to strike after the election?
Oh, I don't know what the timing will be, sir, but they can hit now if they want. We've done nothing to close our borders. Our policemen in this country don't have a chance to defend us. If they wanted to hit us now, they would have done it already. If they wanted to do car bombs or assassinations, what they want to do is to hit us harder than 9/11, and we have done virtually nothing to protect North America.
What could we do to protect North America, in your opinion, that hasn't been done?
Well, the two things we needed to begin the day after 9/11 was to close our borders using the U.S. military until we could find out who was in our country and until the police had a chance to protect us. The second thing we could have done is to secure the Soviet nuclear arsenal, because that's the biggest threat to America. Money is no object for the Islamists. They have promised to detonate a weapon in our country, and they have religious authority to kill 10 million people. And yet the last two administrations, Republican and Democrat, have reduced the manpower and the money devoted to securing the 22,000 weapons in the Soviet arsenal.
Oh, my God. So we're all sitting here like Pollyannas, assuming tomorrow is going to be brighter than today, when in fact you're an expert who's telling us tomorrow could be not only not brighter than today, but it could be blacked out altogether.
It could be a very disastrous tomorrow, Mr. Dr. Savage. It's a extraordinary.
Oh my God! I don't. You know, sometimes I tell you, I swear, Michael, it's hard for me to actually believe that could happen. But in my heart of hearts, when I look at the government, the bureaucrats, I know that you're right. When I listen to the head of Homeland Security give a speech, or when I listen to any of these clowns, I have a feeling that they don't really have a grip on what they need to do.
The only thing they have a grip on, Dr. Savage, is what they need to do to get reelected. And much of that involves lying to the American people about the nature of the threat we face. And they consistently underestimate it.
Michael, you've been on the show before, and we've gone through these nightmare scenarios, and we've both gotten ourselves crazier than we were to begin with fear. But let me ask you something. When you say they want to do something bigger than 9/11, you're talking about what size? What kiloton size?
Oh, I think they would use any weapon they could get, sir, whether it was one kiloton or two kilotons, because they have three goals in attacking America: maximum human casualties, maximum economic damage, and maximum psychological negative impact on the American people.
All right, what happens the next day? What does the President of the United States do the day after tomorrow? The day after the bombs go off in one or more American cities, God forbid, do we finally take definitive action, and against whom?
Well, that's exactly the point, which that's the point I wanted to make, sir, that It was so important to protect North America to the maximum because really for the first time in history, a great power like ourselves could be attacked here at home tomorrow and have absolutely nothing to respond against that would make a military difference vis-a-vis our enemy. There is no target that can hurt our enemy at the moment. We could bomb Mecca. We could bomb Medina. We could bomb the Iranians. And that might make us feel good, and it might be worth doing, but in the long run, it makes us more enemies. Continental defense was so very important, Dr. Savage, because of this odd situation where our enemy cannot be pinned to a specific location that we can destroy.
Well, I disagree with you a bit on that. You know, I've heard that and I've analyzed it from my perspective, Michael. Let me run this by you. You know, you're a man who's dealt in these scenarios all your life. I haven't. I'm a strategic thinker, but not in defense matters. But I want to just run what I would, as a talk show host and businessman, consider doing. We know that these operatives that are here are not operating on their own, that they're funded and they're instructed from afar. We agree on that, right?
Well, at least, sir, they receive instructions from afar, but one of the unique qualities of Al-Qaeda is that its people find legitimate jobs in foreign countries so they don't have to have wire transfers or any kind of financial transactions, for the most part, back to their headquarters.
I see. So they could be working for an aerospace firm or even for the U.S. government. Nice American citizens. They go to the mosque on Friday, and if they go at all, if they want to show any religious affiliation, or the church, for that matter, by what we're reading, they may be that far along, blonde hair, blue-eyed, although I kind of doubt it. What do you think about that? What about the ethnic racial makeup of the potential terrorists? Can we talk about that, or is that too uncomfortable?
Well, it's not uncomfortable for me, sir, but we know that Al-Qaeda has been after white-skinned, blue-eyed Europeans and Americans for a long time. And they apparently are having some luck with the increasing number of Europeans who are converting to Islam from atheism.
Mm-hmm. So atheists have found God through Islam, and the one thing their God now tells them to do is kill? What kind of religion is this?
Well, everything is a matter of how you perceive things. And as much as we dislike it, sir, they think that our policies and our actions in the world are an attack on their faith. And as ridiculous as that is, the perception is widely held in the Muslim world. And they
Yeah, but you see, this is upside down. Why do I care what the Muslims think of us? Why don't they care about what we think of them, what they do to children, what they do to women, how they treat themselves, how they hate dogs? Doesn't that tell us more about them? Why should we care what these ignoramuses think of us?
I don't think we need to care how what they think of us, except that it is... posing, it results in a threat to us. And
all right, fine. No, I'm not questioning your loyalties, but I know it may have some. What do I care what they think? When did America ever walk around worrying about what people thought of them overseas? We were the beacon of the world. Okay, fine. Now is now, that was then. Let's get down to brass tacks. The bombs go off, God forbid, 1 to 4 cities, 1 kiloton. City centers are wiped out. And what does the leader of the country do? Why can't he go after the city centers of the Islamic nations that we know are our enemies? I don't have to go through the list. You know the list. Tehran, Beirut. There are several cities. What about Syria? There are several cities you know that harbor terrorists. These are the godfathers of terror, aren't they, Michael?
Well, they are, sir, and I think the one you didn't mention is Riyadh, and they are responsible for more terrorism today than either the Syrians or the Iranians.
So the peasant Avante, you're saying, is the king of Saudi Arabia?
The king of Saudi Arabia and his predecessors have given to this world a kind of Islam that is resulting in this near-civilizational war, yes. The Saudis are directly responsible for that, sir.
Do you believe the Saudis, who are very intelligent men, do you believe these Bedouin warriors, with all of their money, believe that by toppling America they will take over the world?
I think they believe it's their religious duty, sir, and they also don't care what happens outside of Saudi Arabia. The only reason they're working with us at all against terrorists is because there was an attack in the kingdom. Whatever happens outside the kingdom, they couldn't care less.
So therefore, it goes back to my perception that if you go after the Godfathers, you can stop the button men in the streets, can't you?
You can certainly put a dent in them, sir, but our leadership over the past 30 years in both parties have made us the slaves of the Saudis. They now control oil, and they own a great deal of our debt. We cannot take action against them without grievous economic damage in our own country.
Michael, look, you've been there. You've been inside these chambers arguing with men, doing war games and scenarios. Is this dim? The people inside these chambers don't think the way you do?
No, sir. I think it's a pretty my views are pretty well held across the intelligence community at the levels that would be below the level of lieutenant colonel in the military. Once you get to the senior levels, you become a politician and you only want to please your master, who is the president.
So they're just like the schmucks who run the major corporations, who can't think clearly, whose products nobody wants to buy. The people are running away from the corporate America's products, buying products created by more creative companies, whether they be Japanese or Chinese. And the American corporations continue to produce products nobody wants. And the schmucks who run the corporations continue to fire people and lose money and make hundreds of millions of dollars going out the door. So that's like the political structure, the same thing.
It seems to me they're of one piece, sir.
I see the same thing, Michael. And I don't care what the industry is. You can go across the board from ballpoint pens to automobiles. These guys, these country club guys in American corporate life at the higher levels, they're not the men who built the companies. These are the men who got the MBAs and pogo stick their way to the top. They're the very same MBA mind that you see in the military. And that's why we're in the terrible shape we're in economically and militarily and socially and et cetera. Michael Scheuer, Marching Towards Hell, will be back in a moment for just a few more precious minutes with the Savage Nation. Don't miss it.
Savage.
End of the day, if you focus solely on the bottom line, as most corporate managers do, the MBAs who have no loyalty to any nation whatsoever, they are telling people to bail out of the dollar, teach their children Chinese, and move out of the country. These people are Quislings. These people are in government. These people are at the highest levels of our corporate structure. That is why we're sitting ducks. Michael Scheuer, welcome back for these last few minutes on the Savage Nation. Should we take out Ahmadinejad, the Hitler of our time? Would that cause World War III or prevent it?
Well, I'm all in favor of using that kind of tool of a assassination tool if we believe someone should be taken down, sir. I think that we've wasted over 4,000 lives when a 50-cent shell could have taken out Saddam is a criminal activity. I'm not at all opposed to using assassination as a weapon.
But here you got Ahmadinejad, who is threatening to launch the world into World War III, saying he doesn't believe that the Messiah can come until the 14th Mehdi, whatever crazy maniac thing he believes in, that there must be an apocalypse for peace to occur. The guy's insane. He's threatening to wipe out an entire nation with genocide and saying it's worth losing half the Iranian people to do it. The world sits there like a bunch of scared little children. And I'm asking over and over again, you were there. Aren't there missiles the next time this madman gives a speech with his mullahs that couldn't be sent into that podium?
There's the United States has an array of weapons that can take care of any problem it needs taken care of, sir. It's a matter of will and the political leadership.
Okay, will. So Bush will never do it because he's a lame duck president. He doesn't want that part of his legacy. Israel seems to be unable to act. They become a bunch of old women hiding under the covers. So who's going to do this? Answer, nobody. He's going to get a nuclear weapon, and then he's going to use it. And then what happens?
Well, it'll be a little late then, but we'll probably pound the hell out of him.
Uh-huh. After the fact, to say, you see that? He did it first. So in other words, to save lives, we should do it now, but that's never the way things are done.
That's exactly right, sir, in my experience. The only disappointing part of my career in the United States government was that protecting Americans never came first.
Oh, God. Marching Towards Hell, Michael Scheuer. Well, the next time you're in San Francisco, Michael, will you make sure to give me a call? We can sit down and talk about this over a beer.
All right. I'd love to do that, sir.
I'd love to do that. I'd like to meet the real man. Thank you, Michael Scheuer, for being with us on the Savage Nation. Investor says avoid the dollar at all costs. Move to China. Teach your children Chinese. Invest in commodities. and this is considered a sage, I would not let him back into the country. I'd burn his passport. I would burn his passport for this. That's what passes for corporate
savage
wisdom today.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Times over the last 16 months, I found for the first time my patriotism challenged. At times as a result of my own carelessness, more often as a result of the desire by some to score political points and raise fears and doubts about who I am and what I stand for. I will never question the patriotism of others in this campaign.
That large squadron in the air, in the Navy that he commanded, it wasn't a wartime squadron. He hasn't been there and ordered the bombs to fall. He hasn't seen what it's like when diplomats come in and say, I don't know whether we're going to be able to get this point through or not. Do you want to take the risk? What about your reputation? How do we handle it publicly? He hasn't made those calls. Well, I don't think riding in a fighter plane and getting shot down is a qualification to be president.
Yeah, well, now we know why Obama will never question anyone's patriotism, because he's got something to hide and they don't. I mean, the whole issue of patriotism is the issue. Nobody can question John McCain's patriotism, while anybody with a rational mind can very seriously question Obama's patriotism, and they should. Now, why do I say that? Why do I say it's a very valid question for a man who would be the leader of the United States of America? Why? Because it's the most fundamental question. We all know they're egomaniacs. We all know they're pathological power madmen. We understand that's a given. That's the common denominator amongst all politicians. That's a given. And we all know that some of them cater to special interests more than others. We don't know who the special interests are. And that's a given. Right from the beginning, everybody feathers their own nest. Those are all givens. But when it comes down to patriotism in a time of terrorism, you're darn right we have a right to ask about a man who has a questionable past. Now, what is it questionable about Obama's past? Well, let's start with some of his buddies. William Ayers, known terrorist, who said he didn't do enough. They only killed two policemen. He would have killed and could have killed more. Let's start with the little tete-a-tetes and the teas they had together. Let us go all the way back to Hawaii, the days he sat at the feet of some of the worst left-wingers known to mankind in this country. Some of the worst were his mentors in Hawaii while he was still Barry, sitting at their feet learning how to cater to the left wing in order to get ahead. He knew that he was a bright kid. He knew that he was a smart kid. He knew that he was a brave kid. He knew all of that. But he didn't have that extra something, that oomph, to be moved up inside the left wing circles of Hawaii. Well, soon he learned what it is that the masters of deceit wanted to hear. And so, therefore, we need to know who these masters of deceit were in Hawaii. At whose feet did Obama sit in Hawaii? What did they teach him? What about his pastor, Reverend Wright? Not God bless America, but God de America. That doesn't count? We have no right to ask a man why he sat in a church for 20 years where a pastor who hates America so deeply exposed himself? Was exposed? Know about any of this? We have every right. In fact, we have every obligation to question the patriotism of Barack Hussein Obama and anyone else who would be president. Every presidential candidate that this country has ever seen has had their patriotism paraded before the American people. Even Jimmy Carter, the leftist, was a nuclear submarine officer. And that worked an awful lot to dispel, rather, for me, a lot of questions about Jimmy Carter. Of course, I was wrong. I thought that being a commander of a nuclear submarine would automatically qualify him as a patriot. Little did I know that Jimmy Carter himself was a mole, in my opinion. A man who hates America to the core. A man who did more damage to this country than any 10 presidents who were no good. So, yeah, the person's patriotism matters. It matters an awful lot, not only for the presidency, but for every other political office. And so, of course, Obama's going to get on his high horse and say, I will not question the patriotism of anyone running for office. Sure, because they've got nothing to hide in the case of McCain, while you may have a lot to hide. And people say that getting shot down and serving 5 years in a prisoner of war camp and not being broken is not qualification. Well, if that's not a qualification, then tell me what running a community organization in Chicago handing out flyers is. You mean flying a jet and leading a squadron, a naval squadron, is not qualification? Does not qualify to be commander-in-chief? But pasting flyers to a telephone pole is qualification unto itself? So by their own argument, they've shot themselves in the foot. I think we're going to take this topic when I come back right here in the Savage Nation. Be here, because there's nowhere else to be. You heard me coin the phrase Islamo-fascist. Now, it's important to understand just how historically accurate that description is. Rabbi David Gildalen is a conservative rabbi and author. His new book that he co-authored is entitled Icon of Evil, and it links the fascism of the last century with the Islamo-fascist terrorism of this century. Rabbi David Dallin, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Michael. I'm delighted to be on your show. Thank you so much for inviting me today.
Tell us about your book.
Well, this is a book about Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Mufti of Jerusalem, who spent the war years, World War II, as part of Hitler's inner circle in Nazi Germany. The roots of Islamofascism and of radical Islam as we know it today go back to the Mufti, Haj Amin al-Husseini. We argue in this book unequivocally that he was the founding father of radical Islamic anti-Semitism and terrorism as we know it today.
Well, what did Hitler love about the Mufti?
Well, this is amazing. The Mufti established, he first came to the attention of Hitler in the 20s and 30s. The Mufti established his anti-Semitic credentials, which brought him to Hitler's attention by instigating and leading the murderous Arab uprisings against the Jews of Jerusalem and throughout Palestine, starting in 1920, but especially in 1929 and 1936. And he was always a great admirer of Hitler and of Nazi ideology from the moment that Hitler had taken power. And he cultivated Hitler, and he was invited in 1941 to come to Berlin. And the roots of, they formed an alliance. I would say that the inextricable link between the old fascism and the new, between the fascism of Nazi Germany and the fascist ideology that permeates much of the radical Islamic world today is the Mufti. Now, the genesis of this goes back to a meeting that took place on November 28, 1941. Just 9 days before the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, when the Mufti, Haj Amin al-Husseini, met with Hitler in Germany and made a deal and formed an alliance that with Hitler that continues to shape our world today.
Tell us about al-Husseini during the war years.
At Hitler's invitation, the Mufti spent the war years in Berlin. And in our book, the readers will learn how the Mufti ingratiated himself with his hero, and Hitler really was his hero, and other Nazi leaders. He became a member of Hitler's inner circle, a close friend of Eichmann and Himmler. Now, it's amazing, Michael, to realize that the Mufti visited Auschwitz, the Nazi death camp, and chastised the Nazi leadership for not being efficient enough in their extermination of the Jews.
What?
As we document, actively collaborated with Hitler and really was one of the architects of Hitler's final solution that, of course, resulted in the mass murder of 6 million Jews. During World War II, al-Husseini was called the Führer of the Arab world. He recruited more than 100,000 Muslims in Europe to fight in Muslim divisions of the Waffen-SS. And it's amazing to realize he was responsible for the creation of the Muslim Waffen-SS unit that massacred 90%, 12,600 of Bosnia's 14,000 Jews. And to further recruitment here, he wrote a viciously anti-Semitic book entitled Islam and the Jews, which was distributed to Bosnian Muslim SS units during the war as part of his efforts to incite the murder of Bosnian Jews. He worked closely with Joseph Goebbels, the Third Reich's propaganda minister, and organized and planned Nazi propaganda broadcasts throughout the Arab world. And most of his very passionate pro-Nazi broadcasts were classically anti-Semitic, designed to incite hatred and violence against radical Islam's greatest enemy, the Jews. In one of the most infamous of his many such anti-Semitic broadcasts, the Mufti urged his fellow Arabs to murder their Jewish neighbors with the following admonition: "Kill the Jews wherever you find them," he proclaimed. "This pleases God, history, and religion."
What about after the war?
The Mufti escaped indictment at Nuremberg, where he surely would have been convicted as a war criminal. He resurfaces in Cairo, Egypt in 1946, where he's welcomed as a hero, and he becomes the mentor to a very young Yasser Arafat, who happens to be a distant cousin of his, and to a new generation of radical Islamic terrorists who are friends and associates of Arafat. Now, we document the details of his relationship with Arafat in rather great detail, but what's less known also, he was also another protege of the Mufti, was the uncle of Saddam Hussein. And we know that the Mufti met with Saddam Hussein's uncle on visits to Baghdad and presumably with Saddam Hussein himself in the late 50s and 1960s.
So al-Husseini's legacy is that he's a founding father of modern radical Islamic anti-Semitism. That's wonderful. It should be loved by the left.
Just as al-Husseini has been the inextricable link between the old fascism and the new, so too he has been the inextricable link between the old anti-Semitism and the new. In recent decades, as we document conclusively in this book, a new and insidious Islamic anti-Semitism, which has its roots in the anti-Jewish ideology of Nazism, has become pervasive throughout the Islamic Middle East. Much of this virulent anti-Semitism and anti-Semitic literature that is widespread today throughout the Islamic Middle East was inspired and promoted by one man, the Mufti. It was al-Husseini in the decades following World War II who introduced European anti-Semitism into the Middle East, promoting the Arabic translation and widespread distribution of notoriously anti-Semitic publications, including the Protocols of the Elders of Zion and Hitler's autobiography, Mein Kampf. The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, as your listeners may know, is an infamous forgery dating from Tsarist Russia that purported to document the existence of a secret Jewish conspiracy or cabal to rule the world. Despite the fact that the protocols had been discredited as a forgery even before the 1920s, they continued to be accepted as authoritative scholarship through much of the Islamic world. They were inspired and promoted by al-Husseini, and as a result of that, the protocols have been publicly praised and recommended by various monarchs, presidents, and other political and intellectual leaders of radical Islam. Former Egyptian President Nasser and King Faisal of Saudi Arabia, for example, praised the book and recommended that it be widely read. And King Faisal actually ordered all Saudi hotels to have copies of the protocols as bedtime reading and often gave copies of the Tsarist forgery to the guests of his regime. And one of the most amazing anecdotes is that when former U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, who of course is Jewish, visited the Saudi capital in the early 1970s, he was one of the many visiting diplomats to receive a copy of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion from King Faisal.
Unbelievable to me.
The protocols were serialized in a leading Tehran newspaper during the Khomeini regime and became a number one Iranian bestseller. Now, Hitler's Mein Kampf, another favorite anti-Semitic publication of the Mufti and his proteges, has similarly enjoyed a wide and appreciative radical Islamic audience in recent decades. When Mein Kampf was republished, and this is amazing, Michael, to realize, by Yasser Arafat's Palestinian National Authority in 2001, shortly after the September 11th terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, it achieved immediate bestseller status throughout much of the Arab world. New Arabic translations and editions of Mein Kampf have recently appeared in Turkey, Lebanon, and Saudi Arabia. Indeed, what's amazing to realize, today there are more Arabic editions of Mein Kampf than German.
Are you kidding?
In Icon of Evil, we provide unequivocal evidence that al-Husseini's actions and writings have served and continue to serve as the inspiration not only to the late Yasser Arafat, but to the leaders of Hamas, Hezbollah, al-Qaeda, and other terrorist organizations pledged to destroy Israel and the United States. His unholy legacy of anti-Semitism and anti-Jewish violence and terrorism and anti-Western and anti-American terrorism has been an enduring one. In the 60 years since the Holocaust, Haj Amin al-Husseini, who was not only the founding father of the radical Palestinian national movement, he has been and remains the inspiration for the leaders of the PLO, of Hamas, of Hezbollah, al-Qaeda, and other radical Islamic groups in their campaigns of violence and terror against Israel, the United States, and their allies and friends. The terrorism, the fanaticism, and ruthlessness of the Palestine National Movement reflect the enduring legacy and influence of the Mufti. Today, more than 30 years after his death, he died peacefully in 1974 in the Middle East. Haj Amin al-Husseini deserves recognition as the icon of evil that he was, as the father of radical Islamic anti-Semitism and terrorism, once again, as we know it today. As we document in our book, the radical Islam that the Mufti and his followers espoused during the 1930s and 1940s has today become dominant in much of the Islamic world and has continued to be the ideological source and inspiration for global anti-Semitism, jihad, and terrorism throughout the latter half of the 20th century and into the 21st. And we argue that the challenge of terror from radical Islam is the great issue of our time. As Adolf Hitler and Haj Amin al-Husseini were decisively defeated in their day, the new icons of evil must be unconditionally vanquished in ours.
Rabbi Dallin, thanks for being on the Savage Nation.
Michael, thank you so much for having me on your show. I was delighted to be your guest today, and I'm tremendously appreciative.
Savage. Democrats' cultural liberalism makes their party inherently hostile to the interests and values of the workers of America. But today's Republican Party lacks a clear message that speaks to their economic aspirations. Ross Douthat is a 2002 graduate of Harvard University and a senior editor of The Atlantic. He has written a book entitled Grand New Party about how the Republican Party can focus on the interests and needs of the working class voters. Ross Douthat, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me on today.
So tell us about your book.
Sure. It's a book about the situation the GOP finds itself in now, the problems it's having, and how it can get out of them. So half the book is sort of a history of how the Republican Party went from being defined as the party of the rich to being the party of middle America and the working class. And the second half of the book is about how Republicans can continue to win the working class vote.
Give us an example of one of your recommendations.
The biggest thing, basically, is that Republicans won the working class by addressing four big issues, four big challenges to working class life: crime, dysfunctional government, the threat posed by the Soviet Union, and the threat posed by a crippling tax burden. And each of those threats has been, you know, if not completely vanquished, then partially turned aside. So what that means is that Republicans are victims of their own success. That, you know, the tax issue doesn't resonate the way it did when Ronald Reagan was running for president in 1979. The crime issue doesn't resonate the way it used to when crime rates were sky high. The Soviet Union no longer exists. And so what this means on domestic policy is that Republicans have to find the issues that, you know, the threats to working class life of today. And I guess one of the biggest ones would be the issue of public order as it relates to both to immigration and then also to crime rates more generally, which have started inching back up. The crime issue is going to make a comeback. And obviously securing our borders is part of any reasonable public order agenda. So that would be near the top of the list. And then also just recognizing that basically you hear a narrative a lot from the American left that America's working families are getting poorer and poorer, that the American economy doesn't work anymore, and so on. And Republicans need to challenge that narrative, but they also need to do more to help working families, people dealing with issues of rising costs of health care, people dealing with issues of family breakdown. And the decline of the American family is actually the number one driver of economic distress for most Americans, divorce rate, out-of-wedlock birth rates, and so on. So these are issues that Republicans need to get their hands around going forward.
What do you recommend on immigration?
Well, I think the problem that Republicans have had is that, you know, the party, immigration ought to be a winning issue for the GOP, but they haven't found a way to frame it because you have this divide in the party between the elites and the grassroots, where the elites generally don't want to listen to the grassroots. The grassroots say, look, immigration's a problem. The border is the primary problem. And the elites say, no, you know, we need comprehensive immigration reform. We need cheap labor from Mexico and so on. But the problem is the grassroots alone can't, you know, the grassroots can't work without the elites in some sense. You have to get at least some of the party elites on board. And there has to be a way to find common ground between the two. And the common ground, for instance, if John McCain actually believed in his stance on immigration, which, you know, right now is supposed to be secure the borders first, and then we'll figure out what to do about, you know, immigration rates and immigrants who are already here further down the road, that could be a winning stance for the GOP. The problem is McCain doesn't really believe in it, and he keeps obviously giving all these winks and nods, about how, well, really, as soon as he gets in the White House, it'll be back to pushing for comprehensive immigration reform. But there are also issues, I think, issues of assimilation, issues of how we teach English in our schools, issues of how we teach civics, how we, you know, make Americans into new citizens, where, you know, where conservatives, even conservatives who disagree about what the immigration rate should be, ought to be able to find common ground. This is what John Fonte, he's a scholar at the Hudson Institute, he calls this civic conservatism. And I think that, you know, this, again, ought to be an obvious winning issue for the Republican Party, especially in a race, you know, a race against a figure like Barack Obama, who stands for a more multicultural vision of America. And, you know, he'll give speeches about how, you know, the problem in America's schools ought to be learning more, you know, more about Harriet Tubman and Sacagawea and so on, when actually the problem in America's schools runs the other way, that it's, you know, too much, all Harriet Tubman, Sacagawea, not enough George Washington.
Well, you agree that we need to decentralize our educational system, eh?
Yeah, America's university system, I think it's basically what you have is a situation where, you know, both at the university level, you have too many schools trying to be Harvard, basically, and too many federal dollars going to, you know, schools that wish they were in the Ivy League and, you know, are sort of spending all their money on lavish campuses and so on, when in fact most Americans who are going to college aren't trying to go to get the sort of four-year Ivy League experience, and they certainly aren't going to get the four-year liberal academic Ivy League experience. There's a reason that distance education is booming, that trade schools are booming, places like the University of Phoenix that offer online degree programs are booming, and ultimately there's no reason for the federal government and state governments to be subsidizing universities that are there to educate the children of the upper middle class. If you look back at how the American higher education system was supposed to develop, it was supposed to be a mass opportunity system. It was supposed to be federal money for, you know, people getting the degrees they needed to help them with their careers later in life. And instead, you know, if you look at like lots of big state schools like the University of Virginia, right across the river from me, and I'm in D.C. there in Virginia, you know, these are places that don't need you don't need state governments propping up schools that, you know, have multi-million or even billion-dollar endowments on their own. And that's true in, at the university level, and it's true at the local level, too, that, you know, you need – I mean, this is – there's been a conservative mantra about, you know, increasing competition, whether it comes from school vouchers or homeschooling or what have you. I think in the book we talk about expanding that agenda a little bit and, you know, that conservatives should still be pushing for school vouchers and absolutely should still be supporting parents' right to teach their children at home. But there's also real opportunities for conservatives to talk about increasing choice within the public school system and getting public schools. You know, liberals like to champion sort of individual charter schools, these schools where, you know, you actually can hire and fire teachers when they're good or bad and can actually discipline students and so on. Conservatives need to be talking about taking that model and applying it to the whole public school system.
And what are your ideas on welfare reform?
Welfare reform is the biggest, bar none, the biggest domestic policy success, I think, for conservatives over the past 25 years. And it's a case where conservatives came in and found the welfare state failing and actually fixed it, made it work much better than it did before. You tend to have this sort of either-or debate among conservatives where it's, you know, either we just have to do what the liberals want with the welfare state or we can't say anything at all because we just have to be for smaller government. But a lot of these bureaucracies, you know, and it's true in welfare, it's true in education, it's true in healthcare, they aren't going away anytime soon. But there are things that conservatives can do to make them run better. And welfare reform was a big success, but conservatives have sort of shied away from building on that success. In part, I think, and understandably, because, you know, a lot of people who are invested in the welfare system aren't likely to be voting Republican. But what we point out in the book is that, you know, those kind of categories are really fluid, and there are a lot of poor Americans who are on their way up, and, you know, who are gonna be Republican voters at some point if they can get ahead. And so basically, what we talk about is just moving the welfare system even more towards a kind of workfare model where you're helping people who are already have jobs. And we talk about programs of wage subsidies, basically of assisting people as they move up the income ladder rather than just either paying people not to have a job or, you know, what liberals want to do basically is they just want to raise the minimum wage, which basically means you go to a place like Walmart and say, look, the government's going to tell you how much to pay your employees. And instead, conservatives should be championing a system where the welfare system is there to work with places like Walmart. So Walmart is going to offer you a wage, and then, you know, if it's a very low wage, if you're just entering the workforce for the first time, the government's going to be there to help you out a little bit, but help you out less and less as you move up. So there aren't any incentives to just, you know, stay in dead-end jobs.
Well, what are the real chances of McCain doing any of the things you recommend in your book?
I think pretty low. I mean, I think that McCain, you know, if you look at it from the broadest point of view, McCain has the right idea. You know, he thinks of himself as a reformist conservative, and he's absolutely right that conservatives can't just keep saying the same things over and over again. You need some reform. You need new ideas. The problem is, and this has always been true of McCain, is that he's most attracted to the ideas that the New York Times editorial page wants him to be attracted to. He's attracted to boutique issues, to causes that the media loves, whether it's anti-tobacco legislation or campaign finance reform and now, obviously, you know, climate change, global warming legislation. And these are issues that makes the D.C. press corps love you, but they aren't issues that anybody actually votes on, and there especially aren't issues that working and middle-class voters vote on. They aren't kitchen table issues. That's always been McCain's problem, and I think it's going to be his problem in this campaign, too. He's not good at talking about health care, taxes, education. He's very good at talking about sort of good government causes.
Mm.
I think the biggest challenge, and this goes to the McCain point, but I think there are, you know, everybody in the Republican Party recognizes the party's in trouble, right? But I think that there are two big misguided responses that people have. One response is to say, well, we're in trouble, so we just need to copy what the Democrats are doing. We just need to be the Me Too Party. And that was what the Republican Party used to do back before Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan. And it's a great way to get to, you know, 45% of the vote, but it's a really bad way to have a majority. So that's one temptation. And the other temptation is just to say, you know, no, we just need to get completely back to basics and, you know, just run the way Ronald Reagan ran in 1980. But it isn't 1980 anymore. It's 25 years later, and if Ronald Reagan were alive today, he'd be doing something at least a little bit different from what he was doing back then. So conservatives need to change, they need to reform, but they don't just need to copy the Democrats. They need to find issues that distinguish them from the Democrats rather than just imitate them.
Ross Douthat, thanks for being with us on the Savage Nation.
Thanks for having me on. It was great chatting with you.
Savage.
Obama's flack, Wesley Clark, says that flying a jet in combat and getting shot down does not qualify John McCain for the presidency. Well, if that is true, then by the same logic, what does putting posters up on telephone poles in Chicago qualify a man for? And so, therefore, whichever way you cut this, they lost very bad, and it's so bad that the only good news is that Machiavellian character Wesley Clark is now permanently finished in politics, which is the only good news. Now, I don't know the man. I've never met the man. I know he's a highly decorated man, sincerely, and a very brave man. These are facts about Wesley Clark, and nobody should besmirch his honor in that regard. However, as a politician, he's just simply been horrible. He was horrible when he bombed the Serbs illegally, committed war crimes in the opinion of millions of people by killing 2,700 innocent Serbs, destroying every bridge on the Danube River, which was a war crime by any definition, as well as the other henchmen of the Clintons. So this is ancient history that's never going to be dug up because the media is owned by the Democrat Party. But having said that, the issue of patriotism has become front and center again in this election, as it should, because Obama's patriotism is questionable for a number of reasons. He didn't wear a flag pin. He's hung around with very, very anti-American people. His pastor hated America, which we're not making up. You can listen to the speech yourself. I mean, I don't want to play it for effect. I can do that at any time, and I will. Actually, no, not right now. I'm not in the mood to listen to that harangue. So, no, his patriotism should be questioned, but not McCain's. This man is beyond reproach in one area. McCain is terrible when it comes to illegal immigration. McCain is terrible when it comes to so many issues. But on one issue, the guy is rock solid. He's as good as gold, and that is patriotism. For them to go after him on the one issue that he's strong shows a terrible lack of judgment on the part of the Obama campaign. But I wouldn't expect anything more from former SDS members, Students for a Democrat Society, hardcore Marxists. That's who's behind Obama. You read the pack of them, their curriculum vitaes are Students for a Democrat Society. These are hardcore Marxists in their youth. God knows what they really still contain in their heads today. But you don't have to go any further than his preacher, which is contemporary. You don't have to go any further than William Ayers, which is a contemporary situation, not something in the fossilized past. I mean, you can forgive anyone their youthful indiscretions. Me, you, anybody. You don't have to carry that around in a person's life. People change. I've changed. You've changed. You grow up and you start seeing things differently. And so, no, you don't have to carry that around forever. I mean, Robert Byrd was once a Ku Klux Klan member, wore a sheet. Doesn't mean you consider him a Ku Klux Klan member today. Jesse Jackson spit in the salads of white people. We know that he's probably changed his opinions today since he lives off the largesse of corporations that he intimidates, in my opinion. So people can change. Al Sharpton was a bullhorn outside Freddie's Fashion Mart, is now a very, very respected civil rights leader. Just look at Fox News tripping over themselves with the reverends. He's the most reverend. He's more reverend than anybody. He's the irreverent reverend. He's the most reverent reverend. So people can leave their past behind them, even if it consisted of egging people on to murder. But in the case of Obama, we're not talking about his past. We're talking about his present loyalties and where they lie. Why do I say that? Again, his preacher. His preacher is an important part of this man. You don't go sit in a church for 20 years that hates America and attacks America and say that it has nothing to do with you. If you don't like the rhetoric, you walked out. I don't know how many houses of worship I tried in my life that I walked out of. I walked out of them sometimes because I was bored, sometimes because I thought their politics were too far to the left. I've walked out of many houses of worship. In fact, I never found one I liked. And yet I'm a man who believes in God. Why? Who am I not to believe in God? Who am I to say I don't believe in God? What do you think, I'm bigger than God? I created myself, as the man once said to me. Follow your logic in your own head. As the homeless man once said to me. Remember that story I told you? I was once, more so then than now, I don't do it anymore. I was into talking to strangers. I was into, like, the, you know, the wandering man who would talk to weird people, figuring they held the truth, some truth when I was younger, you know. Well, now I hold my own truths. I don't need to talk to strangers for my own opinions. I can come up with my own. But when I was younger, I talked to a lot of odd people. One of them was a itinerant man. You'd call him a bum, but he wasn't really, because he wasn't really dirty. He wasn't disheveled. He didn't look like a homeless man, but he was. He had a backpack. He had long white hair. He wasn't particularly clean. He wasn't particularly dirty, but he was not an alcoholic or a drunk. So I talked to him about this and that. And I forget his name. Oh, his name was, I remember it right now. His name was the same as Moses. His name was Moses or something to that effect. So I said to him, do you believe in God? I remember to this day, it was on Columbus Avenue in San Francisco. And I looked at him and he had startling blue eyes. And he looked at me and he said, as though in astonishment, he said, why, who created you? And in that instant, I had a satori. I understood more completely than I ever have through any preacher or rabbi what it was all about. Follow it back. Do you believe in God? I say to the itinerant man. He says, stunned. Why, who created you? I got it in that flash. Flash of understanding, the satori the Japanese talk about. Follow it back. So you're an atheist and you say, well, how do you know there's a God? So what is there? There's nothing? So nothing created you? So you believe in nothing, therefore you believe in something, but that's nothing. You believe in nothingness. I believe in God. That's all. How can you believe in nothingness? How is it possible to believe in nothingness? How can something come from nothing? It's a violation of all the laws of physics. Something cannot come from nothing. It violates all the laws of physics. Physical science, biological science, theological science. It violates all the laws of reason. It violates all the laws of non-reason. So what I'm getting at is, I learned from that man. So then I said, can I drop you off where you're going? He got in my Volkswagen at the time, and I drove him to a freeway overpass that no longer exists. Yeah, it was a 280 freeway somewhere near the Mission District. And the man got out, and he said goodbye, and he disappeared. I never saw him again. Who was he? Was he a prophet? Was he a reincarnation of a religious figure? Was he reincarnated? I don't know what he was. Maybe he was just a smart guy who was a bum. A lot of bums are smart, and a lot of corporate guys are not that smart. They play people for fools. They think that everybody is a fool because they control the money. What they don't understand is that there are values beyond money. They've never learned that. And unfortunately, our government is exactly the same. It's MBA all the way. MBA all the way right up into the military hierarchy. They think that an MBA makes them a war hero. An MBA makes them a war hero and a sage. But they'd sell their country out for a pound of flesh. And they'd sell their country out for less than 30 pieces of silver. They would teach their children Chinese and move to Shanghai if they had a better offer. Not me, buddy. This is the Savage Nation.
Savage.